Good evening. I'd like to welcome you all here to our Newman Lounge at St. John University Parish for this special event. We want to welcome Dr. Angela Franks, who's here this evening to speak with us. So it's exciting to have an event we sponsor through campus ministry for the students, but one that's open to the public, to parishioners, to the entire local community as we learn and discuss this topic that certainly regards each of us, that is important for each of us. That is this question of human life, our relationality, our sexuality. And so we will be listening to Dr. Frank speak on the theme of Humanae Vitae at 50 years, this 50th anniversary of the papal encyclical on human life and the transmission of human life. So I'm going to use the flyer as a cheat sheet just to introduce Dr. Franks. Angela Franks is a theologian, speaker, author, and mother of six. She serves as professor of theology at the Theological Institute for the New Evangelization at St. John's Seminary in Boston. Her areas of expertise include the thought of Pope St. John Paul II, theology of the body, and the eugenic roots of Planned Parenthood. She's the author of a number of books, two of which are here. Two's a number. Yeah. These books, which you can check out afterwards, Contraception and Catholicism, published in 2013, and Margaret Sanger's Eugenic Legacy from 2005. She's spoken at numerous conferences, including the International Theology of the Body Congress, and on many national radio and TV media outlets. And we are honored and delighted to add St. John University Parish to that list of places where you've spoken. So, Angela, we welcome you.
Thank you. Neglected to mention that this is my one-time home parish, so I've actually eaten donuts in this very room. I don't know if you guys still do that. I'm going to be talking a little bit today about our current situation. And one of the things that's striking to me is that, you know, for as long as I can remember, it seemed to me that the message that we get from our culture is that you are not allowed to question the sexual revolution. You know, basically, the sexual revolution is the unquestionable value. And it's the interesting thing right now is that, you know, outside gender studies departments, people are talking about sex and power, and these questions are starting to bubble up. And so it's an interesting time, it seems to me. And so I want to spend some time exploring our current situation a little more. And one of the things that I think marks our current situation is that we've come to some kind of bare minimum consensus. It's not very deep, but we've got a bare minimum consensus, at least, that there is such a thing as bad sex. Like that, this seems like really kind of actually a great leap forward in some ways in our culture to have that kind of consensus. I think we're not very good at saying why some sex is bad. I don't think we have very good language for that yet. Hopefully we'll develop that a little bit today. There's a movement out there you might have heard of called sex positivity. And to be very simplistic, sex positivity basically says, you know, any sex with anybody is probably a good thing. That's the basic idea of sex positivity. The most important thing to make sex moral under this worldview is that there be consent, simply. And it's one of the things that's come under question today by people who are not Catholic, who are not involved in the kind of conversations we're involved in the Catholic Church, you know, secular feminists and so forth, are starting to question this idea of sex positivity. And so one of these feminists wrote, positive for whom? Right? Like, what do we mean when we say sex positivity? Is it positive for Harvey Weinstein and Matt Lauer? Like, is that the best we can do? Is that the culture that we have? And I think we can push this a little bit, right? What makes sex good, right? If we agree that there is such a thing as bad sex, then what would make sex good? And if you ask the question, you just kind of throw that question out there, especially in the university community, you will get all kinds of interesting answers. But one of those answers will probably be, at least, pleasure, right? That's kind of the going thing. That's going to be the first answer that a lot of people are going to jump to. Well, what makes sex good? Pleasure makes sex good. Okay, well, pleasure's great. Nobody's anti-pleasure, right? But the question is this sufficient to enable us to say, okay, so here's the dividing line between bad sex and good sex, and pleasure is the thing that makes you step over the line. If you think about it, a pleasure-based sexual ethics cannot take into account exactly the kind of questions that our culture has started to ask about. If pleasure is the only thing that makes sex good, why in the world would a woman not consent to somebody like Harvey Weinstein, right? As long as he's sexually adept, right? Like, I mean, the pleasure-based sexual ethics basically implies, you know, sex is like a buffet bar, and we'll all sort of belly up to the buffet bar and enjoy ourselves, right? And then walk away, and no problem, no strings attached. If that's all that sex is, then there's really no reason why anybody would ever say no, as long as somebody's sexually adept, right? What a pleasure-based sexual ethics cannot take into account is the fact of vulnerability, which is exactly what women have been talking about in situations of harassment and pressure, that they feel threatened, they feel vulnerable, right? And that's a dynamic that pleasure really can't speak to. I think it's helpful to draw a comparison to food. If you think about it, if you think like a biologist, eating, sex, there's a lot of analogies you can draw between the two on at the kind of biological level. So let's think about food a little bit. Now, ideally, eating is pleasurable, right? But let's think about why we eat. What's the purpose of eating? Do we eat because it's pleasurable? Maybe sometimes, but is that really like such a good idea to just, if the goal of eating is pleasure, right? What happens if somebody simply eats for pleasure? You get things like obesity and eating disorders and what have you. Things go weird, right? When pleasure becomes the goal. But eating, it's quite simple. We know that we don't actually simply eat for pleasure. We eat, why? To stay alive, right? We eat to nourish ourselves. It's this basic need. The reason it's pleasurable is so that we'll do it, right? I mean, if eating were like actually not enjoyable at all, like we might all be at the risk of starvation, right? So biologically, it makes sense that eating is pleasurable. It incentivizes us to do it, right? So pleasure is a byproduct, but it's not the goal itself. When it becomes the goal itself, that's when things get weird. And so like food, something similar with food when we're talking about sex, because the byproduct of sex is that it is pleasurable because it incentivizes us to do it. Because, you know, so this is a true story. I was once in a moral theology class in a seminary. I think I was the only woman in the class. A seminarian raised his hand, very perplexed, and he said, "Why did God make sex so pleasurable when it causes so much trouble?" And the professor at the front of the room sort of rolled his eyes like, "Oh Lord, why do you send me these students?" I recognize the look now that I'm a teacher. And the professor said, "If sex were like calculus, the race would have died out long ago," right? So there's a reason why the things that we need to do are pleasurable, but the goal isn't pleasure, right? The pleasure incentivizes us. Okay, so pleasure, nobody's denying that sex is pleasurable, but pleasure is not going to be enough to give us the kind of moral language that we need to talk about what makes sex good. The other major answer that we have in our culture today is consent, right? So the idea is, did she consent? Did she not? If she did, it's good. If she didn't, it's bad. Now, obviously, consent is like a baseline. You know, it's the foundation. But it's still pretty thin, right, if you think about it. It's necessary, but it's not sufficient yet to be able to talk about what makes sex good or bad. Because think about it, haven't you possibly consented to things that were not actually very good for you? Have you ever consented to something that was actually kind of demeaning, maybe? One of the things that's come out in recent days is women telling their stories of being in relationships that they were in a sexual harassment situation at work, and they consented to be in a relationship with their boss. And then they describe how difficult these relationships really were, how they felt used, how they knew they were being used, how it caused kind of long-term trauma. A lot of them like left the field altogether. You know, they just left television, for example. They just couldn't deal with it anymore. Just because you consent to something, consent's not like this magical fairy dust that magically makes an action good. Right? Again, it's necessary, but it's not enough to make an action the kind of act that is actually a good act. It's a starting point. But you still have to ask the question, what are you consenting to? There's a Catholic thinker, Helen Alvray, who's a law professor, who coined this kind of clunky term, sexuality-ism. And the reason I like it is because what she's trying to express in this term is that one of the problems with an ethics of consent is that we have all kinds of pressures put on us by other people, by the culture, to agree to certain things. And she's zeroing in especially on the pressures that we have to consent to sexual activity. So if you think of sex positivity, right, you know, the assumption being any sex with anybody is probably a good thing. That's kind of the baseline assumption. If something is a good thing and you say no to it, you kind of have to defend yourself. So if you had a friend who comes up to you and announces to you that she's giving up sleeping, maybe this happened during finals, I don't know, but I'm giving up sleeping, you'd be like, why are you going to do that? Like, she would have to defend herself for choosing something that's like, for rejecting a good thing and choosing something that's unhealthy. People in our culture who are put in positions of asking for consent for sexual acts, people feel this pressure that this worldview of sexuality-ism puts on them. In other words, they feel pressured to consent. The default is yes in our culture. In a culture of sexuality-ism, the default answer to the question, do you want to have sex, is yes. Right? And if you say no, you have to defend yourself. If you've read any of the accounts of women talking about being in hotel rooms with Harvey Weinstein, one of the fascinating, scary things about it is that out of the two of them, which one felt defensive? The woman. The person who felt like she had to defend her decision to say no was the woman. Harvey Weinstein doesn't act defensive at all. Right? He acts like he is, you know, owns the place, when in fact he probably does. The problem, this is the problem of a culture like sexualityism that puts pressure on us to consent a certain way. And so this, it's a myth that it's this kind of neutral thing, you know, oh, sex, yes, no, you do you, it's all good. It's not all good. There is a, sexualityism puts a thumb on the scales, right? There's this default to say yes. So this talk is statistics light, I promise, but I do want to talk about a few. And if you're really interested in this, there's a book that I'm getting my statistics from is done by two sociologists, Mark Regnerus and Jeremy Uecker, and the book came out in 2011, and it's called Premarital Sex in America. It's about premarital sex in America. It's not one of those gotcha titles. And in that, they compile lots of like enormous data sets and also do lots and lots of interviews. So it's a very interesting combination of anecdote and data. And one of the things that they look at, they point out that for both women and for men, but in particular for women, that the number of lifetime sexual partners goes up. Anything over zero or one, essentially, as the number of lifetime sexual partners goes up, that is correlated with increased emotional and mental health problems. It is correlated with being more depressed. Women who have more sexual partners are more likely to cry every day. They are more likely to be unsatisfied with life. They're more likely to have been diagnosed with depression or taking antidepressants. They are less likely to graduate, to go to college. It affects their educational attainment. They are more likely down the road to experience dissatisfaction in their marriage. So these are large data sets that show these very noticeable trends where the increased number of sexual partners leads to poorer mental health outcomes. This also explains why this pleasure-based sexual ethics that says, you know, it's just eaten from the buffet bar, nobody has to get hurt here, it's not in touch with reality, because sex is very powerful. People are very vulnerable in the sexual act, and they get hurt. And they get hurt whether they want to or not. And so that's an important element in the picture. I'd like to transition from a diagnosis of our current situation to somebody who had a prognosis of it, and that is the person who's behind the title of this talk, namely Pope Paul VI, who in 1968 released an encyclical, which is a letter to the Catholic faithful and to all people of goodwill. This letter, called Humanae Vitae, was about the question of contraception. And in that letter, there's a very interesting place where Paul VI gives predictions. And it's interesting because there were many things, of course, that he could not predict. He couldn't predict the internet and internet porn and, you know, all of that stuff. But the things that he could not predict actually support his predictions rather than disconfirm them. So let's see, what did he predict? First of all, he realized that if contraception were accepted on a widespread level, he said, first of all, there will be a general lowering of moral standards. If you haven't noticed this, you're like one of six people who hasn't been paying attention. Because, I mean, it's kind of like some of the things that have been coming out recently, even like the most cynical people often have found them a little bit shocking. But secondly, he predicted a rise in infidelity. This is a little bit interesting because it doesn't seem obvious until you think about it. So something like contraception says that sex can be detached from any larger purpose, and we'll be talking about those purposes pretty soon, and in particular that sex can simply be a matter of pleasure. Okay, well, if sex is just a matter of pleasure, why would you be faithful to your sexual partner, right? I mean, it's going to maximize your pleasure possibly not to be faithful to your partner, to have multiple partners, whatever, right? So the detachment of sex from these larger realities and the insertion of sex into a pleasure ethics encourages infidelity and encourages unfaithfulness. Thirdly, he predicted a lessening of respect for women by men. And this pretty much, I think, summarizes the whole hashtag MeToo phenomenon. And then fourthly, he predicted that governments would use reproductive technologies in coercive ways. So let's look at some of the fallout of these things more closely. One of the arguments in favor of contraception was that it was going to reduce the number of unplanned pregnancies. Now, this makes perfect sense, just kind of in the abstract, right? You know, people want to have sex and not get pregnant, give them something that will keep them from getting pregnant, ergo, no unplanned pregnancies. Well, that is not obviously what has happened. And it becomes possible to understand why when you realize that 54% of women seeking abortion use contraception that same month. And only 8% of women coming to get abortions have never used contraception in their life. So basically, in our society, we've reached contraceptive saturation point. Right? I mean, essentially, at least in modern America, there is basically no one who has never heard of contraception or never been told about it. Or possibly, I mean, very few people have actually not even ever used it. And yet we still have unplanned pregnancy, we still have abortion. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about that in a minute, why that is. And another reason why really, people of goodwill have thought that more contraceptive use would be a good thing would be to lower the number of abortions. And so this frequently comes up in arguments about this. The interesting thing is that it doesn't work. Okay, I mean, again, the equation is simple. People are having unplanned pregnancies that leads to them to have abortions. Give them something to keep them from getting pregnant, fewer abortions. It seems like, you know, it should be just mathematical. So this is data from Spain, but this has been confirmed in other countries, England, the U.S. But in Spain, for example, a 63% increase in the use of contraception, okay, was correlated with a 108% increase in the rate of abortion. And there was an economist who crunched these numbers, and he argued that increasing access to contraception might actually increase long-run pregnancy rates. Why in the world? That seems very weird, right? But if you think about it, it's not so weird. So what contraception does is encourage women to feel safe in entering into relationships that sociologists call risky sex. In other words, sexual relationships with men who are not likely to support them in the case of a pregnancy. So one or both partners is in this relationship has no interest in a child if a child happens. But because somebody's taking contraception, there's this sense that a pregnancy is not really a possibility anyway, right? Here's the thing about contraception that nobody really talks enough about. User failure and method failure are realities. They are pretty much intractable realities, unless you think it's a goal to just like sterilize like all women everywhere, which some population control programs have basically advocated for. But outside of like surgical sterilization, user failure and method failure always happen. So if what you have are especially a drunken population, possibly, who are not as likely to use contraceptives well anyway, if you've got a population that is engaging in more sexual activity with partners who are not going to support them in the case of a pregnancy, you're going to have more pregnancies because of user and method failure, and because it's going to be in situations in which people are not prepared for a baby, you're going to have more abortions as a result. So contraception has not served to lower the abortion rate. If anything, it's served to raise the abortion rate. I want to talk just for a minute. I wrote a whole book, and it's my thicker book. I promise I won't talk too long about this. But I want to talk just for a minute about that last prediction of Paul VI about governments using reproductive and anti-reproductive technology coercively. Here you have an example of Margaret Sanger, who was America's first effective, really, birth control advocate, and she was the founder of Planned Parenthood. With Sanger really typifies, but she's by no means unusual, she typifies a kind of eugenic attitude that you found in the birth control movement, really across the board. It was a very elitist kind of mindset, and they generally believed in eugenics, which meant reducing the reproduction of the people they considered to be unfit. And this attitude was often folded into population control programs or proposals, which was sort of eugenics with a passport. So here's just one small example of Margaret Sanger from 1920 saying that birth control is nothing more or less than the facilitation of the process of weeding out the unfit, of preventing the birth of defectives or of those who will become defective. So one direct result of this kind of social engineering was found in particular in population control programs in places like China and India and Peru, but also here in America, where you had coerced or forced either abortion or sterilization going on, in particular targeting poor, minority, and institutionalized women. So that is a very real and sad history. This eugenic mindset is an example of what Pope Francis calls technocracy. And this is a term that he develops most in most depth, I think, in Laudato Si, his encyclical on the environment. And there he says that technocracy is a technique of possession, mastery, and transformation. It is as if the subject were to find itself in the presence of something completely formless, completely open to manipulation. In other words, what Pope Francis is saying is if we think the natural world is just basically Play-Doh for us to squish into whatever shape we want, that's going to hurt the world because the world has its own reality. We can't just make it into whatever we want it to be. It has its own reality already. Well, if you think about it, sex and the human body, those are natural realities, right? Those are part of nature too, and they have their own reality. And if we think it's just Plato, it's like, yeah, well, I don't like sex being this way, I'm going to make it this way. Pope Francis's point is this is going to come back to hurt us. And that's what he's trying to call attention to. All right, so all of this is very depressing. This is like the depressing part of the talk. So let's try to synthesize some of this in order to say, okay, bad sex, we've got a sense of what we, you know, that sex has to be more than just pleasure. It has to be about more than just consent. Sex involves vulnerability. Sex requires that we're receptive to the reality of sexuality itself. So let's try to understand what this reality actually is. How could we have better sex? And so Pope Francis, in continuing as he's criticizing this idea of technocracy, he says there's an alternative. And the alternative to technocracy is, he says, respecting the possibilities offered by the things themselves. What are the possibilities? What's the reality of the natural world, of the environment, of the human body, of sexuality? Let's be attentive to those. Not what do I want it to be, but what is it? What is it already? So to do this, we can go back to Paul VI in Humanae Vitae. And there, Paul VI talks about two meanings of sex. He says sex, if we're being receptive, if we're trying to understand what sex is all about, he says it's always about two things. And the first of those, again, if we go back to our biologists who are so helpful in the example of food, they can also help us here with when it comes to sex because, as you know, if you think about it, it's called the reproductive system for a reason. Biologically, sex is the act that's oriented towards creating new little creatures, new little humans, or whatever we're talking about. And so sex is, in fact, reproductive. Like, that's part of its reality, that it is oriented towards reproduction. Now, obviously, we're not just, you know, beetles or bison, but neither are we entirely unlike them either. Right? We are rational, and that makes us distinct in the world. But we are also animals, right? We're part of this natural world, and we have to respect that about our very bodiliness ties us to the natural world. And so the sexual act in human beings, it ties us to the entire human race. It ties us to a future. This, I think, is the one of the reasons of the vulnerability of sex that people don't pay enough attention to. Why does sex make us vulnerable? Well, because with this person that we're having sex with, we could potentially be tied with them to the future forever, right? And that's kind of an awesome / scary sort of thing that the sexual act can do that, right? It can take us to places that we don't even know, you know, a future that's completely unknown. And that's part of the power of the sexual act, precisely that it is reproductive. That's what makes it, in fact, more interesting than, you know, eating from the same buffet line. But when sex connects us to the future and to another human being, it does it with another person, right? And so Paul VI says that procreation or reproduction is one meaning of sex, and the other is unity, or you could think of these as babies and bonding. And what we know, in fact, not as well known in Paul VI's day, but we know a lot better today, that there's a biochemical cascade of things going on when people have sex. You've got oxytocin involved, you've got dopamine, you've got pheromones in the air. There's things that are happening bodily that are designed to unite us to our sexual partner. And these things happen whether we want them to or not. You know, the hookup myth is like, yeah, it's actually possible that I could sleep with somebody and not care if he calls in the morning. And lots of testimonies indicate that that just doesn't work well. And the reason it doesn't work well is in part because at a physical level, we're being bonded to our sexual partner. It's not just a matter of what we want to do. It's what's actually happening. So sex means babies, and it also means bonding. And this is for a good reason, because if you've got a vulnerable little human being coming into the world, that person is going to thrive in a stable, bonded family setting, right? And so there's all kinds of good reasons why we're being bonded to our partner. So Humanae Vitae speaks to this. It speaks about the inseparability of the unitive and the procreative meanings of sex, basically of babies and of bonding, that they're inseparable. So that when a couple is open to having a child, this bonds them more. And when they have a child, this bonds them more. And when they're bonded, they're more open to having a child. So there's this virtuous circle going on. But there can also be a vicious circle in the sense that if a couple's not open to having a baby together, well, that means there's something they're not willing to share with each other. It's like, well, you know, I'm not really willing to go into the future with you. Like, I'm going to share only so much, but, you know, I'm going to hold back here. And what we know from, you know, relationship studies is that that kind of holding back is not good for relationships. And so there can be a vicious circle, too. What contraception does, as Paul VI pointed out, Paul VI pointed out that contraception structurally makes sex not about these bigger realities of babies and bonding, of a child and of my partner. But what contraception does structurally is to make sex about me and my projects. And so what Paul VI warned is that you're structurally making sex selfish. Now, what he's not saying is that, you know, every couple who is contracepting is like deliberately being selfish or anything like that. But he's saying the act itself is being closed off to things beyond me and my projects. And that's really dangerous to do, especially when we're talking about something as powerful as sex. When we close it off and make it just about me and my projects, then we're structuring it in a selfish way. And when sex becomes selfish, that's when people get hurt, right? When sex is about me and my projects, then we've got all of the heart, you know, the broken hearts and all of the pain that we've been seeing. Now, one of the things that's come up, especially recently, is an argument that you hear from some Catholic voices who are saying, well, the most important thing when it comes to sexual ethics is that you follow your conscience. And obviously, following your conscience is extremely important. I think there can be some naivete in how this is discussed, though, because sometimes it makes it sound like, you know, as long as you follow your conscience, that's automatically making your sex into good sex. And again, I don't think our consciences are that powerful. The problem is reality. And so, for example, I'm reminded, I don't know if people have seen that classic movie Mean Girls, but there's like a chief mean girl, right? And the protagonist of the movie, who's kind of being like a quasi mean girl at the moment anyway, but the protagonist of the movie convinces the chief mean girl to eat these nutritional supplements because chief mean girl, of course, wants to lose weight. And so she's like, yeah, eat these and you'll lose weight. And she eats them and she gains weight. And so she thinks she's doing something wrong, so she eats more and she gains more weight. What's the problem here? Like, her intention was great. Right? Her intention was, I'm going to lose weight. But she was engaged in the kind of activity that worked against that intention, right? That's how reality is, right? We can have an idea in our mind, but if we engage in certain kind of acts, they can work against the intention in our mind because reality is more powerful than what goes on in between my ears, right? You know, you eat the caloric nutrition bar, it's going to make you fatter, right? So what Paul VI is trying to note, so the church calls contraception, it puts contraception in this class called intrinsically evil actions. What intrinsically evil actions are actions that are structured in a way that they oppose love. Again, it's not saying that people don't have loving thoughts when they might choose them, but that the actions themselves fight against love. They pull people towards selfishness and away from gift and away from love. And so contraception is one of those actions. Like, we've seen the fallout, right? Nobody says, well, I'm going to have multiple sexual partners because I want to cry every day, right? I mean, like, that's like exactly nobody's idea. But that is, in fact, what there's more likely to happen, as we've seen, right? If you engage in certain activities, it will have effects whether you want them to or not. And so immediately going to conscience without saying, but have you formed your conscience, right? Have you asked yourself, what's a good act? Have you asked those hard questions? Are you being receptive to reality, or are you being pulled by desires that might not be as generous as you think they are, right? And so that's the challenge with conscience, not to just say, well, as long as my conscience says it's good, it'll be fine. You might still get hurt, and other people might still get hurt. This then leads to a discussion about what is treated in the encyclical. We call it natural family planning, or NFP. In the encyclical, it's called periodic continence. And a lot of people think that this is a prime case of Catholic hypocrisy, because the idea is, well, natural family planning is just Catholic birth control, right? You say no to birth control on the one hand, on the other hand, you allow NFP, and you can't have it both ways. This confusion is based on an understandable misconception, which is that the most important thing for an act when it comes to moral action is what's going on in between your ears. What is your intention? And so we've already talked about this a lot, really, that there's the intention, and then there's the action. There's the action that you do with that intention. So here's a good intention. Support myself financially. Great. Great intention. Perfectly fine. Okay. What do? I rob the Quickie Mart. All right. Well, not so great, right? So we can take good intentions and engage in bad actions in order to carry out those intentions. And the act's still bad, right? Because we've done something wrong with our intention. When people confuse NFP and contraception, all they're looking at is the intention. Because the intention is the same. If you've got an NFP couple, contracepting couple, the intention for both of them is avoid pregnancy at this time, right? The intention's the same. But that's not enough yet, right? What are you doing with the intention? So with a contracepting couple, what they're doing is deliberately sterilizing the sexual act. Pills, barriers, you know, various ways. The NFP couple is abstaining from sexuality, from sexual activity during certain times of the month. Okay, what times of the month? Well, this is where NFP is a very woman-centric kind of practice, because guys, more or less, you're basically fertile 30 days a month, so 31 days a month. We just ignore you. All right, forget about the guys. All right, the women, however, have a cycle, right, where fertility ebbs and flows. And when women are fertile, her body, a woman's body, gives off signs of fertility. So that morning, every day, a woman can check and see if she has signs of fertility, and she'll know, am I fertile today? So for most couples, it means, if they're trying to avoid pregnancy, that they abstain from sexual activity between 6 and 10 days a month. There's one study, there hasn't been a lot of studies done on NFP because it's not, you know, one of these, it hasn't taken over the world yet. One study showed that NFP practicing couples had more sex per month than contracepting couples. And if you think about that, I think you can figure out why. So it doesn't actually affect the total amount of sex, but it's a structured sort of thing, right? The couple chooses to have sex only when the woman is not fertile. Why is this a good thing? Because it's respecting that meaning of sex that says sex is fundamentally reproductive. Sex is oriented towards babies. And if we're not prepared to accept babies right now, we're not prepared to have sex. And so as I like to say, it's asking for self-control rather than birth control. Rather than technologically fiddling with the sex act, it's just calling the couple instead to exercise self-control and to respect sex as being reproductive. So I think that NFP is really, in many ways, the way out of our mess, that kind of mindset, because NFP is fundamentally receptive to the sexual act. I think what we have in our culture is a lot of fighting against sex, you know, fighting against it being unitive, I don't want to have to care about the person, you know, fighting against it being procreative, I don't want to have babies, fight, 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 and we fight with pills, and we fight with barriers, and it's exhausting, and people, you know, are like worried, is it going to work, you know, am I going to get pregnant anyway, and it's a very stressful kind of existence to be constantly fighting something. If instead we're receptive to it and we work with it instead of fighting it, it's a much more harmonious way of living, where it's an acknowledgement that, yeah, this is a really powerful act. It does really powerful things. And I'm going to work with it instead of assuming that somehow I'm going to master it and just be able to tinker with it and make it whatever I want it to be. It doesn't work. That's what we found. Sex's procreative potential is very powerful. Sex bonds people. All of this stuff is happening. And people are getting hurt because they don't expect it. They've been told you don't have to have babies. Nobody ever has to have a baby if they don't want to. And people then don't know what to do when they do get pregnant or when they do bond with their partner. So the church is trying to offer a way forward, working with sex rather than fighting it. And this is, I think, the teaching that the church has. You know, you can lay down your arms. you can surrender and work with it and be at a lot more peace. So on that note, Father alluded to my books. I have a couple books up here. I'd be happy to sell them after the talk or talk to you about them. But until then, we can have a little bit of time for questions. So thank you very much.